Okay, we're working off of handout 7 still from last week. So where we are in the overall outline is we're finishing up the history section leading up to the Maccabean period. We're almost through it. We're at the last section, which if you remember from the last 2 weeks, we're in the period of history after Alexander the Great's conquest. And we're in the period of history that's sometimes called the Diadochen period, which is the four divisions of his empire. And we're focusing on the two dynasties that ruled that period, the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria and in the east into towards Persia. And we've already covered the Ptolemaic dynasty, which had power over the Jerusalem area for about 100 years. And we've moved now to the period of Seleucid dominance of Palestine. And so last week, what we did is we covered the first rulers up to Antiochus III. And actually, if you have your family tree, figure 4, that's a good thing to have handy. So we made it down to Antiochus III, which is on the right-hand side. So the first four Seleucid rulers were... All of this is happening in parallel, of course. The Ptolemies are ruling Egypt. The Seleucids are ruling the Syrian area with Antioch as the capital. And we switched from the Ptolemy side over to the Seleucid side there at Antiochus III, who's called the Great. And we covered up through him. And the other important thing to remember at this period in time is a new power has entered the scene. So up till now, it's, you know, we went from the Persian Empire to Alexander the Great's conquest, and it's been dominated at this point for the last 100, 120 years by the remnants of Alexander's empire. So it's, my kids are studying this period in their school right now, and they talk about it as the Greek period. So even though it's the Egyptian power center versus the Syrian power center, it's all sort of Hellenized. So it's Greek rulers. And so you'll hear this period of time referred to as the Greek period. But remember now, there's another power coming on the scene in the West, and that's Rome. And so Rome, I'm not covering Rome at all at this point, but Rome, just for background, is beginning to assert its power in the West. And eventually Rome will conquer Spain, Europe, and start pushing into Asia Minor towards the East. And that's going to be happening very soon. In the records that I'm reading or that you read about this period, the later part of this period, the shadow of Rome is looming in the background, and people are beginning to have to defer to Rome. You remember that Antiochus III, he ran up against the Romans in Asia Minor. And you start to see Roman influence even in the east now, in Syria and in Egypt. So Rome is beginning to become a power to be reckoned with that people are beginning to be a little bit afraid of at this point in time. So that's kind of looming in the background here. On the outline, we made it up to Antiochus IV, which is number 4 on your outline. So we made it through Antiochus III, and then he had a son, Seleucus IV, who we covered last time. And he had a relatively brief reign and then was assassinated. And that brings us to Antiochus IV. Now, Antiochus IV is a very important figure because this man is really the catalyst for the great persecution that broke out in Jerusalem and the subsequent revolt. And so we'll spend a little bit of time talking about Antiochus IV. And he has the title Epiphanes. So I'm going to begin by reading some passages from Daniel as background. So what we'll do is we'll read the passages from Daniel, and then as we go along and see how those things were actually fulfilled in history, we'll try to refer back to the passages that we read earlier. So I'm going to read first from Daniel chapter 8. Again, I'm not going to go into the details here. I'm just reading it at this point, just for background, just listen to the things that are going on, and some of it then you'll recognize when we start to see how things actually played out in history. So I'm going to read verses 9 through 25 if you're following along. we've read before, this is the prophecy of the ram and the goat. You remember that we read earlier with respect to Persia and Alexander the Great. Remember, he was the first horn, and then that horn was broken off, and then four horns arose, which, of course, refers to the divisions of Alexander's empire, and that was in verse 8. So picking up in verse 9, out of one of them, that is the four horns, out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it, together with the regular burnt offering, because of transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end." And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end." And now here he begins the interpretation of the ram and the goat, which we've read previously. In verse 20, "As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power, and he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand." So in that section, the little horn that we just read about and the king of bold face. So the king of bold face and the little horn is almost a certain reference to Antiochus IV, who we're going to be covering here. So just keep that in mind. Now, if we turn over to Daniel chapter 11, this is another vision at this point. Now, remember, we already read verses 1 pretty much up through 19, which was the kings of the north. Well, it covered Persia, Greece, and then remember the kings of the north and the south battling back and forth. And that's, again, the north is the Seleucids, the south is the Ptolemies. So whenever you hear north and south in this passage, that's what it's referring to. But now we'll pick up in verse 21. Now we've made it up to this period. And I'm going to read 21 up through verse 35. "In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant." And you'll hear some of the same language in this passage that we just kind of read in chapter 8. "And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his fathers' fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and the fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. And they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help, and many shall join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white, until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. All right, is that clear to everyone? These are very interesting passages. This section that we just read in chapter 11 is a pretty detailed description of the political intrigue of Antiochus IV's reign. And it actually keeps going in verses 36 and following. I think a lot of scholars believe that that later section refers to something that hasn't yet come to pass, that would be more referring to the time of the end and the Antichrist figure. But at any rate, we're going to focus on Antiochus here, and we'll start to unpack some of what happened in history, and you'll start to see how the things that are in the prophecy in Daniel were actually fulfilled in history. So back to this man now. So he was the son of Antiochus III and a younger brother of Seleucus IV. That's why on your family tree there, I believe they're right next to each other. Yeah, they're right next to each other there. So Seleucus IV and Antiochus IV were both sons of Antiochus III. Now, remember before we mentioned that Antiochus IV was a hostage in Rome, and we talked about how it was a common practice to hold the son of the ruler captive so that they had power over him. So here we see Rome again as sort of a power behind the scenes. So Antiochus IV had been a hostage in Rome while his father was ruling in Syria. And he was in Rome for about 12 years. And while he was there, he came to appreciate Roman life and power. He made a lot of friends, as you might imagine. So remember, these hostages were not like locked in a prison somewhere. They had a lot of freedoms. And they were viewed as princes. They were royal princes. So they were held hostage, but it wasn't the kind of hostage that you might think where they were locked in a prison cell somewhere. They had a lot of freedom to partake of education, and they were probably moving in, you know, sort of aristocratic families and circles and things like that. So he had made a lot of friends while he was there. Later, after he was released, he went to Athens and made friends in Athens. And his brother, remember, assumed to the throne. That was Seleucus IV. But when his brother was assassinated, he returned to Syria and basically ousted the guy Heliodorus, who had assassinated his brother. And he took over the kingship. Now remember, we mentioned that who was the legitimate heir to the throne when Seleucus was assassinated, who was the legitimate heir to the throne?
Demetrius.
His son Demetrius, right. And so when Antiochus came back and took over the kingdom, he wasn't the rightful heir to the throne. And so that's why you may have noticed when I was reading the passages in Daniel that it referred to the fact that he wasn't really the rightful, it didn't really belong to him. I forget the exact terms that were used in Daniel, but you can see those allusions in Daniel that he was a little bit of a usurper. And so that's what that's referring to, was the fact that he isn't the actual heir to the throne, the rightful heir to the throne. The other thing you might notice is his name there on your outline, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. So what does Epiphanes mean? You know what an epiphany is, right? Well, Epiphanes means manifestation of God. How's that for a humble humble title? Yeah, that's right. He named himself that. He wasn't named that by other people. As a matter of fact, we'll talk next about what other people called him. If you look at the back of your handout there, Antiochus the Fourth, you can see the coin that he minted. And you can see that inscription is right on the coin. I mean, you can see a lot of things on this coin. On the one side, we've got the diademed head, so him wearing the crown. And on the back side, you see Zeus holding the Nike scepter, which is a symbol of military victory. And you can see the inscription there, which translated, of King Antiochus, God manifest, victory bearing. Okay? So there's God manifest. That's the translation of Epiphanes. So that's the coin that he minted during his time. So he took this epithet upon himself, meaning manifestation of God, which, you know, gives you some indication of what he thought of himself. Now, his enemies, interestingly, used a variation of this, Epimanes, which means madman. And it's really because of his eccentricity. So he was an interesting character. We've met a lot of interesting characters along the way here, but he was right up there with the top of them. He was viewed as an oddball by the royal group and the people in power because he consorted with the commoners. He took their dress. He acted as a commoner. He played music. He went to the public baths with the commoners. And all of these things were, you know, not things that a king did. And so he was viewed as a madman because of the way that he consorted with common folk. And there's stories about him sliding around on the floor of the baths, all soaped up and stuff, and laughing and everything. You can imagine that that's, you know, might be an interesting thing to do as a private citizen, but as the king, you could see how that would be viewed upon as something that a king wouldn't be doing, sliding around in the public baths with the commoners. And so he was viewed, because of his eccentricity and his behavior, is really a madman, and his enemies use this term to refer to him, sort of as a little play on words there. Well, what happened here at this point is we see a major change in policy towards the Jews. And you remember before, his father, Antiochus III, had had a good relationship with the Jews and had promoted Hellenization, but he was allowing them to still practice their religion, to basically retain the culture. And it was a fairly peaceful relationship with Antiochus III. Well, Antiochus IV, when he came to power, at some point made the decision that he was going to compel Hellenization upon the Jews. Scholars are a little bit not sure on why he decided to do that. It's possible that he believed that this would unify and strengthen his domain if he could Hellenize. You know, because remember, the Jews were viewed as people who didn't really fit in with the rest of the world, right? Because they had their own set-apart separatist religion. They didn't worship the gods of the nations. They had their own strict set of cultural rules and things. And so they were always viewed with suspicion, or they were demeaned by the other powers of the world. You might see some parallels in today's world. So it's possible that Antiochus thought, you know, I'm going to force these people to conform to the rest of the culture around us and strengthen and unify my domain this way, because they're kind of this sort of rebel group that I'm a little bit unsure how what's going to happen with them. So at any rate, for whatever the reason is, we see a change in policy here from peaceful Hellenization to a more forced, imposed Hellenization of the Jews in Palestine. So to give you a preview of that, we'll go over this in a little bit of detail, but to give you sort of a preview of what happened then, Judaism was basically outlawed, is what the end result here was. Hellenization, along with being a cultural shift toward Greek culture, it also, along with that, came religious implications as well. The worship of foreign gods, food offered to idols, you know, those are all themes that we see continued in the New Testament as well, and themes that Christians, early Christians, had to wrestle with. You know, what do we do with food offered to idols and things like that? And you see Paul wrestling with that. Athletic contests, which by many of the Jews were viewed as indecent. You remember, most of the athletic contests took place in the nude, and you can see how that would be offensive to the Jews. And so there's a lot of offensive things in the Hellenic culture that would have really grated against the pious Jews who were not willing to compromise in those ways. Sabbath observance, circumcision, and temple worship were ultimately banned. And so you can see those are all very serious implications for the Jews, right? And they were banned on the pain of death, as we'll see here shortly. The Old Testament scriptures, the Jewish scriptures, and other writings were destroyed. And what was the Jewish response to this? Well, some Jews who are more of the Hellenizing branch complied fairly willingly to all of these changes, but others resisted. There's a passage in 1 Maccabees, which I'll read here, which has a description of those people who willingly complied or acquiesced to the changes. Remember, 1 Maccabees is written from the perspective of someone who was not a Hellenizer, so is adamantly opposed to the Hellenization that was taking place. But this is a description from that perspective of the folks who were willingly going over and Hellenizing. At that time, there emerged in Israel a group of renegade Jews who invade many by saying, "We should go and make an agreement with the Gentiles round about. Nothing but disaster has been our lot since we cut ourselves off from them." This proposal was widely approved, and some of the people, in their enthusiasm, went to the king and received authority to introduce pagan laws and customs. They built a gymnasium in the Gentile style at Jerusalem. They removed their marks of circumcision and repudiated the Holy Covenant. They intermarried with Gentiles and sold themselves to do evil. So that's the perspective of the more pious party who was resisting Hellenization on those who were taking part in it. So that all sets up the stage for a great persecution that happened. But maybe before I delve into that, are there any questions or comments at this time? How many total, or how many were on each side, like what the split was? Like actual numbers? I don't know. So the question is, how many Jews were involved at this point in time? And I don't know. It was, I really couldn't say a number. I can tell you by reference that some of the wars that happened after this, there are figures in the tens of thousands of folks that were participating in the battles on each side. So the Jewish armies, you know, some of them are exaggerated figures, but anywhere from 10 to 80,000 are the kind of numbers that you hear for the Jewish army that was fighting against the Syrians at this time. So I don't know if that sheds any light on the general population. You know, multiply a fighting age male by 3 or something. I'm not sure what the ratio would be, but there's probably a lot of Jews involved here living in Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is sort of the epicenter here, but remember that there's a lot of other towns all throughout Judea and even Palestine in general. We'll talk a little bit later about what was happening in Samaria at this time. There was a big rift began between the Jews and the Samaritans, which we see carried over, of course, into the New Testament. But there was sort of a mixture. Yes, Andy. Right, so the question is, why would Antiochus do this? What was he trying to gain from it? And I kind of mentioned before, and we're not really sure what his motivation was. You know, different people put forth different opinions about it. But it seems to me that he thought that it's possible that he thought that this was sort of a renegade group that needed to be brought in line so that his overall empire would be strengthened. And remember, he was still at war, basically, with the Ptolemy ruler in Egypt. So he had a lot of interest in making Jerusalem and Judea a sort of conciliatory member of his kingdom there, so he could have a strong border and a strong place to do battle with the Ptolemies still at the time. But it's hard to say, I mean, exactly what his motivation was. You see that throughout the history here. It kind of goes back and forth where somebody puts like the iron fist down and then the next rulers will sort of, that's not the best policy. Maybe I should let them do all their religious stuff and they'll be good subjects that way. You know, so you see kind of this oscillating behavior there, the way they were treated. Any other comments? Okay. Let me give you a little bit of background about the persecution that happened. So first of all, it's very difficult to reconstruct the exact sequence of events here. And the reason that is there's a number of primary sources and they don't always present a unified or clear picture of the persecution. So, for instance, there's little consensus on the motivations, the timing, the circumstances, and even the events themselves among the various interpreters. So, for example, how many times did Antiochus interfere in Jerusalem? Exactly when, why, and under what circumstances? It's definitely open to interpretation. And I'll be presenting one particular reconstruction of events here. But just be aware that it's a little confusing. And if you're doing any reading of this on your own, you may come across a person who says something that doesn't sound like exactly what either the Bible says or what somebody else says. So you just have to be aware of that. And it's not because people are botching the evidence. It's because the evidence itself is a little bit hard to unravel, and it isn't always clear. The problem with that is if you just read, now this goes back to something I've said before, if you just read one interpretation of it, you get the impression that that's what actually happened. Because a lot of people I notice don't, some do this well, but a lot of people just present, you know, because they're doing like a survey kind of thing. So they'll just present one plausible thing, reconstruction of what happened. But they don't tell you that this is just an interpretation, and actually there's all these other possibilities that could have happened as well. So you have to be aware of that. I noticed that a lot of people don't even mention the fact that they're giving you a reconstruction. This is, you know, something that you have to wrestle with in all history. You know, when you're doing history, you always have to consider the sources and realize that there's usually a significant amount of interpretation going on in the secondary sources that we're typically reading. One other thing to note here is some background on the priesthood. So this becomes important. Now we're going to, in a future section, probably within the next 2 weeks, we're going to cover in detail what was going on with the priesthood throughout this period of time. Some of you may have already been wondering that, but we're going to get to that. But one thing it's important to know here is that since the return from exile, that is, since the return from the Babylonian exile, the high priesthood in Jerusalem had been held by the descendants of Zadok. Who remembers who Zadok was? Did you have an answer? Other than Pastor, who remembers who Zadok was? He was a high priest during the time of David, okay? And you remember that he was the priest who supported David during the rebellions and ultimately was loyal to Solomon. You remember when that rift happened between Solomon and one of David's other sons who was trying to assert himself and put himself forward as king. Zadok was the one who aligned himself with Solomon. So the high priesthood had been held by the family of Zadok ever since then, including the return from exile. Now, the Zadokite priests resisted Hellenistic influences, which you might expect, up to the time of the current high priest, whose name was Onias III. And I'm just giving you that as background because the priesthood becomes an important piece of what happened here. So the current high priest is Onias III, and he's from the line of Zadok. Now, what were some of the major factors involved here? Well, there were a lot of things going on, and so this is a very complicated situation. First of all, there was a power struggle going on at this point in time between those people who were pro-Seleucid and pro-Ptolemy. So you've got these two power centers in Syria and Egypt, and you might expectedly begin to have factions within the Jews in Jerusalem who were more loyal to the Egyptians versus the Syrians, or vice versa. So there's this sort of political allegiance thing happening in the background that is sort of not too far under the surface here. In addition to that, you have a battle for the priesthood between those people who wanted to take more of a Hellenistic approach versus those who were resisting the Hellenists. And the line of Zadok would be an example of the people who were resisting the Hellenization. So that's happening as well. The other major factor is that Antiochus was still waging war against the Ptolemy ruler. There were two of them, the Ptolemy rulers in Egypt at this time. And he had some setbacks in his wars with the Egyptians, the Ptolemies, and that influenced his attitude here. And you may have heard hints of that in the passage we read from Daniel. It's definitely referred to there in Daniel. So that's all background for all the stuff that was involved here. And again, when you read about this period in history, many of the interpreters I noticed will focus on one of these factors and they'll ignore the others. So you read one person and he'll say, this whole thing came up because of these pro-Ptolemy and pro-Seleucid factions fighting, and it all came to a head, and this is how it all boiled over in this great persecution. Or you might hear somebody that focused completely on the priesthood, or you might have somebody that focuses solely on the military conflicts that were happening in Egypt at the time. And that was the whole reason that these persecutions happened. In reality, it was very complex. There were all of these things were happening sort of simultaneously, and they were all influencing the general air that everyone was breathing at the time. And so what happened is the Seleucids had gained control of Palestine now, which we know, and they were beginning to assert their control over Egypt. And the two rulers there were Ptolemies again, Ptolemy the V and his younger son, Ptolemy the VI. And you can see them on your family tree there. They should be about at the same time in history there. Yeah, you can see Ptolemy the V is lined up with Antiochus the IV there. And then his son, Ptolemy the VI, was also involved. Okay, so that's all background. So what actually happened? If we go to the sequence of events here, the time now is 174 BC. And I'm going to present one plausible sequence of events here that, as I mentioned, there's some interpretation here, but I'm just going to present one plausible interpretation of the events here. So here's some things that happened that led to this great persecution. The high priest, Onias III, the Zadokite priest, was replaced with his brother, Joshua, who in the literature is better known as Jason. And he was replaced by Antiochus IV, and this happened in 174 BC. And what happened actually is Jason went to Antiochus and bribed him and said, if you make me high priest, I'll help you Hellenize the nation. I'll bring in Greek culture. I'm going to build a gymnasium right in Jerusalem. All these things. So he basically bribed him and said, I'm going to cooperate in your Hellenization program. And in here, too, there's also the reigning high priest, Onias, may have been pro-Egyptian, pro-Ptolemy, whereas Jason is definitely aligning himself with the Seleucid or Syrian ruler. So there's the political aspect a little bit in here as well. Well, Jason succeeded, and he was named high priest. Onias III was kicked out of office by the king, and Jason ruled for 3 years as the high priest. He did, in fact, build a gymnasium in Jerusalem, or so we're told. Now, when I say he built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, so when I say gymnasium nowadays, you probably think of a gym with basketball hoops and things like that. And a lot of you are smiling, so I know that's what you're thinking. That's not exactly what a gymnasium was back then. A gymnasium was related to athletics, but it was a way of inculcating and training Greek culture, putting Greek culture into the minds of the youth, mainly the young males at this point in time. So it was actually more like a school where Greek culture was taught. It had a high degree of athleticism involved, because that was, remember, we talked earlier about that was an important part of the Greek culture, was spreading athletic contests and things like that, competitions and things, that was a part of it. But having a gymnasium built in Jerusalem was a big temptation for the Jewish youth, because they were very tempted. A lot of them wanted to be like their Greek neighbors. They wanted to go to the gymnasium and be trained in this and take part in the activities that were going on there. But it had a lot of negative sides relative to religion, as we mentioned earlier. So it was a big temptation to the Jewish youth. Well, what happened next was that another man by the name of Menelaus basically offered more money for the priesthood. So that's the thing. Once the priesthood is up for grabs, you know, you think you're secure until somebody comes and offers more money for it. Well, that's what happened to Jason. Menelaus went to the king and offered more money and said, "Let me be high priest. I'll even do more of this Hellenization than Jason has done." So Jason was the brother of Onias. So he was at least of the same family. Even though he was a Hellenizer, he was of the same family. So there wasn't a violent reaction to him having the high priesthood. This other man, Menelaus, although there's some confusion about who he is, Josephus says that he's another brother, but I think that that's probably unlikely. We learned from the book of Maccabees, that piecing a few passages together, that he was most likely a Hellenizing Jew from the tribe of Benjamin, so he wasn't even a Levite. I think that's a likely interpretation of his lineage. And if that's the case, what do we got going on here now? He was the first non-Levite, non-Zadokite person who was in the priesthood. So you can imagine the repercussions that that would have among the pious Jews of the day. First of all, we had an illegitimate person come to the priesthood in the form of Jason, because he wasn't of the lineage of Onias III. Onias III actually had a son, Onias IV, who we'll mention in a moment. But now we've got a Hellenizing non-Levite who has taken over the priesthood in Jerusalem. So you can imagine how odious that would be to the pious Jews of the day. And then later, in addition to that, Menelaus actually had Onias III murdered in 170 BC. So Onias III, who was the rightful priest, was taken completely out of the picture and killed. So what happened next is, here's where we're starting to get into the military part of it. Antiochus was fighting in Egypt against the Ptolemy rulers there. And a rumor came back to Jerusalem that he had been killed in Egypt. Well, Jason, who had been kicked out of the priesthood, he came back with all of his followers at that point and attacked Jerusalem and forced Menelaus to take refuge in the citadel, which was a fortress at the time in Jerusalem. He was unsuccessful and eventually was forced to withdraw again. But upon hearing this report, so Antiochus wasn't dead, he was still alive. When he heard what was happening in Jerusalem, he returned to Jerusalem from Egypt a year later and intervened militarily. And he killed many Jews and plundered the temple. Okay, and this is kind of the point in time where I'm giving you a two-time invasion of Jerusalem here. Some people think there was only one. That's one of the differences I was talking about. But I'm following a two-time invasion of Jerusalem here, which I think is, my view is, it's more accurate. So this is what's referred to in Daniel chapter 11, verse 28, where it says, "He shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land." Also, if I'll read the version of this from 1 Maccabees. This is 1 Maccabees 1, and I'll read starting at verse 16. "Once he was firmly established on his throne, Antiochus determined to become king of Egypt and so rule both kingdoms. He invaded Egypt with a powerful force of chariots, elephants, and cavalry, together with a great fleet. When battle was joined, King Ptolemy was routed with heavy loss and took flight. The fortified towns in Egypt were captured and the land pillaged. On his return from the conquest of Egypt in the year 143, Antiochus, that's 143, that just disregard that number, that's not an actual year. Antiochus marched up with a strong force against Israel and Jerusalem. In his arrogance, he entered the temple and carried off the gold altar, the lampstand with all its fittings, the table of the bread of the presence, the libation cups and bowls, the gold censers, the curtain, and the garlands. He stripped the gold plating from the front of the temple, seized the silver and gold, the precious vessels, and whatever secret treasures he found, and carried them all away when he left for his own country. He had caused much bloodshed, and he boasted arrogantly of what he had done. Great was the mourning throughout Israel, deep the groans of rulers and elders. Girls and young men languished. The beauty of our women was disfigured. Every bridegroom took up the lament. Every bride sat mourning in her bridal chamber. The land trembled for its inhabitants, and all the house of Jacob was wrapped in shame." And then over in 2 Maccabees chapter 5, "It was clear to the king when news of those happenings reached him that Judea was in a state of insurrection." That's referring to Jason's trying to get the priesthood back. "And he set out from Egypt in a savage mood. He took Jerusalem by storm, ordering his troops to cut down unsparingly everyone they met and to slaughter those who took refuge in the houses. Young and old were murdered, women and children massacred, girls and infants butchered. At the end of 3 days, the victims numbered 80,000, 40,000 killed in the fighting, and as many again sold into slavery." Those may be exaggerated figures. "Not satisfied with this, and guided by Menelaus, who had turned traitor to both religion and country, the king had the audacity to enter the most holy temple on earth. The villain laid his polluted hands on the sacred vessels and profanely swept up the votive offerings which other kings had made to enhance the splendor and fame of the shrine." So there's two different versions of this event where Antiochus returned to Jerusalem and basically vented his wrath against it before he headed back to Syria. And you could see there in the Maccabees passage that he was aided in this by Menelaus. He basically helped him. He basically opened the doors of Jerusalem to him and the temple and allowed him to enter the temple. So we've set the stage now for the major persecution that's going to happen. That, believe it or not, wasn't the major part of it yet. That was stage one. There's a stage two that we'll get into next week.